Это программа «Саундтрек». У микрофона Станислав Анисимов, звукорежиссер Елена Королева. Герой сегодняшней программы – Уильям Генри Пратт, он же великий ужасный Борис Карлов. И вот нам первая страшная сказка на ночь.
Your tongue is thick in your mouth, your throat is hoarse, your lungs are bursting for air. It seems as if the walls of your room are closing in on you, crushing you, crowding you, sealing you off from the rest of the world. And then you awake. It's only been a ghastly dream, a terribly vivid nightmare. But with your eyes open and your hands trembling and your body bathed in perspiration, you relax. At least you're in your own room, safe. It was only a dream. Or was it? This is a tale that the inmates of Bell Prison still whisper in the cell yards and corridors to this day. The story of John Day, a lifer, and his weird nocturnal dreams. It happened long ago, but cell 13, where it began, still enjoys its haunted history. Listen, and I'll tell you about John Day and his nightmare. One night at 12 midnight, the stone and steel corridors of Row A rang with the hoarse, terrible shouts of a man screaming for the guards. The prisoners, so rudely awakened, would normally have grumbled and yelled their annoyance, but something in the horrible moans and sobbings issuing from cell 13 stilled their tongues. Guards rushed to the cell and swung it open to find John Day crouched in the corner on the floor by his bed, now whimpering and crying, his hands to his throat. At the sight of the guards, he blurted about his nightmare. The hands, he babbled, the hands. Thick, calloused, lumpy hands, they were choking me. Oh, just a nightmare, the guards laughed. But that wasn't the end of it. It was only the beginning of many nights when Row A would be similarly disturbed. John Day and his nightmare about someone strangling him became the talk of Bell Prison. And John Day himself, sentenced to life imprisonment, grew steadily thinner and paler. The warden refused to listen to his pleas for another cell. He wouldn't cater to the whims of convicts. The prison doctor insisted that John Day was only shamming because other than a loss of weight, he was organically and mentally sound. But still the nightmare persisted, and John Day's nocturnal outcries became a familiar sound that the prisoners accepted as another wriggle of their hard existence. But one night came a new sound. The escape sirens wailed over the yard. John Day had escaped, attacked a guard, and gone over the wall. The entire organization of Bell Prison went into action. Guards with bloodhounds scoured the surrounding countryside, and only 2 miles away, one guard with his dog came on a strange sight. A teamster with his heavy wagon pulled over to one side of the road, and lying on the ground, still in his prison uniform, his eyes bulging unnaturally in his head, lay John Day. He was dead. The guard approached the big teamster, a burly giant, and questioned him. The story was simple enough. John Day had halted him with a gun to make use of the wagon, and the teamster had fought back. Luckily, John Day's gun had misfired, and the man had been able to get his hands around his throat. The guard shone his flashlight on the teamster's hands. They were thick, calloused, and lumpy. Big, thorny fingers that had strangled the life out of John Day. Only a nightmare, Bell Prison had thought. Just a convict's curious dream. But when John Day's dead body was returned to the prison morgue, the story of cell 13 became the terrible tale that it is to this day. And what of your dreams and your nightmares? If you ever imagine that fingers are at your throat throttling you, don't twist and turn. Wake up. Open your eyes. Maybe it's just a dream, but someone could be killing you.
Борис Карлов – человек, из чьих уст ужасные истории звучат еще ужаснее. А началось все, как это водится, давным-давно, в 1919 году. Именно тогда Карлов перебрался в Голливуд и начал сниматься в кино. Но, как это обычно и бывает, на ролях второго, а то и там и третьего плана, и достаточно редко, ему по-прежнему приходилось искать разовые заработки. И так вот все это продолжалось где-то лет 10. Он успел сняться более чем в 60 фильмах, однако для широкой публики он оставался неизвестен. В 1931 году его заметил в актерской столовой режиссер Джеймс Уэйл. Он тогда искал исполнителя для роли чудовища в фильме «Франкенштейн». И вот встреча состоялась, и он нашел своего актера.
This time we're ready. Everett, ready.
Why, what's the matter?
Look!
There's nothing to fear. Nope. No blood, no decay. Just a few stitches. And look, here's the final touch. The brain you stole, Fritz. Think of it. The brain of a dead man, waiting to live again in a body I made with my own hands. With my own hands. Dr. Valmon, I learned a great deal from you at the university about the violet ray, the ultraviolet ray, which you said was the highest color in the spectrum. You were wrong. Here in this machinery, I have gone beyond that. I have discovered the great ray that first brought life into the world.
Oh, and your proof?
Tonight you shall have your proof. At first I experimented only with dead animals, and then a human heart, which I kept beating for 3 weeks. But now I am going to turn that ray on that body and endow it with life.
And you really believe that you can bring life to the dead? That body is not dead. It has never lived. I created it. I made it with my own hands from the bodies I took from graves, from the gallows, anywhere.
Quite a good scene, isn't it? One man crazy, 3 very sane spectators.
Так начиналась слава Бориса Карлова как культового актера. Монстров среди его героев предостаточно, и мы продолжим рассматривать их, но чуть позже. А пока еще одна история от мастера ужасов. Итак, оглянитесь, нет ли поблизости черной кошки?
You see that black cat just ahead of you? Look out. It may cross your path with a sudden dart of its black furry body. Now, you know that old superstition about not letting a black cat walk across your path. Do you believe it? Well, if you do, or even if you don't, perhaps you'll be interested in hearing the strange tale of Phoenix Darnell and the cat that screamed in the night high above the streets of the city. It was a cold, dreary, rain-swept day when Felix Darnell first met the cat. Felix Darnell was a construction foreman on the Wells Spencer project on the Lower East Side. The Wells Spencer building was already 13 stories high, and with but 7 floors more to go, the building would be one of the mightiest and most ultra-modern structures on the East Side. Now, Felix was a tall, thin, scarecrow of a man. But the muscles of his body were taut and finely strung through his deceiving-looking frame. He was a foreman of an older day. Indeed, he might have worked on the pyramids or the Colossus of Rhodes. But Felix Darnell was a lonely man with no one to share his pride. He ate alone, lived alone, and walked alone. And on this cold, dreary, rain-swept day, he walked to his job, staring down at the pavement. Suddenly, there before him, a long, thin, black cat stalked from an alley and halted on its haunches. Felix Darnell didn't see the cat until he nearly stumbled across it. He snapped out of his reverie at cursed cats. He hated cats. Viciously, he aimed a kick at it. The cat howled in pain and slunk off, miserable and wet in the rain. When Felix reached the project, he changed into his overalls and cap and took the lift to the 13th floor. By now, the rain had abated somewhat, but as he looked at the scaffolds and the catwalks, Felix Darnell was not happy. The rain and the wetness would slow up the job. He cursed again. Suddenly, Felix Darnell heard a crying, moaning noise. A low, fierce sound like someone in agony. Could someone be stuck out on the framework, trapped on one of the catwalks? Taking a flashlight, because the daylight was dark and unnatural still, he stepped out onto the catwalk that ran on a straight line to what would be a southwest corner of the building. He walked slowly and carefully along the thin iron ledge that held his weight. The street yawned beneath him, 13 construction floors down. And then, a dark figure, bald and indescribable, sprang from the dim niche and shot towards Felix Darnell. He had one awful second to see the two eyes burning in the cat's head, the same cat that he had kicked only an hour before. The feline body raced between his legs on the catwalk, and with a horrible scream, he tried to balance himself, fought for survival. His hands clawed at the air, but his weight, thrown to one side by the cat's movement, hung into space for a brief instant before he fell. All in the way to the street, 13 floors below. He landed on a steel beam waiting to be hauled up, and what it did to him was something that would make even a cat turn away in disgust. Interesting tale of revenge, isn't it? Felix Darnell and his black cat. Well, of course, it might have been just a coincidence, but there, look, we can find out for ourselves. A black cat just crossed your path. See him go? Do you mind if I stay with you, my friend? I'd like to see for myself just what happens to you.
Среди прочих, Карлов создал еще один классический образ жанра ужасов – Имхотепа, оживленного египетской магией заживо погребенного жреца из фильма Карла Фройнда «Мумия».
From a creature put together from bits and pieces of dead tissue, as you've just heard, and unfortunately equipped with a criminal brain, I turn next to portraying a terror character for which there was no precedent. Imhotep. An Egyptian priest wrapped in mummy swathes and buried alive for an offense against the gods. Are ancient curses real? Can they endure through centuries, reach out and affect 20th century's modern superstition scoffing man? Played once again by Edward Van Sloan, veteran of Dracula and Frankenstein, The old Egyptologist warned of sacrilege and punishment in these potent words.
Итак, 1921 год. Археологическая экспедиция Британского музея под руководством сэра Джозефа Уэмпла обнаруживает в Египте саркофаг с мумией жреца Имхотепа и закрытый ящик, на котором написано предупреждение о проклятии тому, кто откроет его.
Death. Eternal punishment. For anyone who opens this casket in the name of Amun-Ra, the king of the gods. Good heavens, what a terrible curse.
Well, let's see what's inside.
Wait! You have read the curse.
We recognize your mastery of the occult sciences, Miller. But I can't permit your beliefs to interfere with my work.
Then why did you send for me this afternoon?
As a friend and an expert. Because I saw this find was unique and I wanted your opinion on it.
It is providential that you did.
Oh, come, Dr. Miller. Surely a few thousand years in the earth would take the mumbo jumbo off any old curse.
Oh, I cannot speak before God. Come out under the stars of Egypt. Do not touch that casket.
Каирский врач и мистик доктор Мюллер уговаривают Уэмпла не идти против древней магии. Ральф, молодой ассистент Уэмпла, вскрывает ящик и успевает переписать первые фразы древнего папируса Тота, которым, по преданию, Исида оживила Осириса.
But there is always some foolhardy soul who will dare to open the Pandora's box. And when the young anthropologist in the film did... I came to life with this disastrous result for him.
Прочтение даже части текста оказывается достаточно, чтобы Имхотеп ожил, похитил папирус и сбежал. Проклятие сбывается, увидев ожившую мумию, Ральф сходит с ума.
What's the matter, man? For heaven's sake, what is it?
He went for a little walk. You should have seen his face.
Итак, герой программы «Саундтрек» Борис Карлов, который читает нам сегодня страшные сказки на ночь. Самое время в поздний час заглянуть в зеркало и проверить, не живет ли оно своей собственной жизнью.
Did you ever break a mirror and spend the rest of the day in dread, wondering what awful fate would befall you? It is bad luck to break a mirror, you know. Because the gods in the mirror are protecting you from harm. And when you break your particular mirror, you're darkening the vision of your protectors, and anything is liable to happen. Take the strange tale of Celeste Collins. She was a pretty Irish girl of 21 on this day of her birthday, and the girls in the office were giving her a luncheon party. She was dressing in her bedroom, arranging her hair in a stunning coiffure and admiring herself in her hand mirror. Her hair was her crowning glory, the envy of the girls at the office. And so she preened herself in the mirror, turning first this way and that, completely satisfied with the effect. But she set the mirror down carelessly, and it slipped off the dresser, falling to the floor with a shattering sound of broken glass. Celeste wrinkled her pretty nose and shrugged her shoulders. Just another mirror. At any rate, it was time to go to work. She hurried from the house to catch the subway. While she was fumbling in her purse for the token, it spilled open and all the contents spread out under the turnstile. Reaching under the stile to put her bag together only caused a long run in each of her silk stockings. Then she was an hour late for work because the train stalled in the tunnel and dried up transportation. And at the office, she overturned a bottle of ink on the whole pile of contracts she had typed so carefully the day before. Well, by noon, Celeste decided it was just one of those days when you should have stayed in bed. Although Sir S. Collins was Irish, and the Irish are fey, steeped in the traditions of leprechauns and strange happenings, she was practical and sensible as well as pretty. The broken mirror was just a coincidence and just a silly superstition anyway. And the birthday party that followed erased any doubt she may have had in her mind. The girls wined her and dined her in the little restaurant around the corner. They've even gotten her a birthday cake. And even though the morning had been awful, the rest of the day flew by with Celeste as happy as a bird. And so, at 5 o'clock, she went home. Her birthday had been a great success. It was only an hour later, while she was sewing a dress in the living room, that the doorbell rang. Expectantly, Celeste sprang to answer. It was a delivery man with a large, upright package that towered as high as the door. Celeste signed for it as the man moved the package to the center of the room and propped it up against the table. After he'd left, she eyed the heavy cords that bound the package and suddenly realized that the girls had taken this method of surprising her with a birthday present. Delightedly, she took her sewing shears and cut the cords. The wrapping paper fell away with a hissing noise, and miraculously, there were two Celeste Collins in the room. The one standing away from the table, the other smiling back from the reflected depths of the full-length mirror propped against the table. But Celeste Collins started to scream. The face in the mirror was a twisted, satanic thing, an outrageous caricature of the lovely face before it. Celeste stepped back, overwhelmed with fright. She kept backing up, but the awful thing in the mirror receded with her. And then her legs were halted by the sill of the window behind her. Whirling, Celeste saw her face again in the crystal-clear panes of glass in the window. The same hideous, ghastly smile. With a terrible shriek, she hurled herself at the window and fell through. 6 stories to the cement courtyard below. So you see, my friend, the birthday present was a gift from hell. Of course, Celeste saw only herself in the mirror. But look for yourself. Look into the mirror. Oh, there, you've dropped it. Broken it into a million fragments. How dreadful. I'm afraid you're in for some bad luck.
Раз уж речь зашла о зеркале, то и мы снимем маски и ужасающий грим от Бориса Карлова и вернемся к Генри Пратту. Кто же он такой? Итак, все начиналось как обычно. Он учился в Энфилдской начальной школе, затем Оппингемской школе, частном училище Merchant Taylors в Нортвуде и лондонском King's College. Но он рано заинтересовался театром, исполнял роли в рождественских сказках, а в 9 лет выступил в роли короля сказочных духов в постановке «Золушки». Итак, часы бьют 12, и мы отправляемся вслед за Борисом Карлофом, если, конечно же, не испугаемся последствий этого путешествия.
Are you one of the frightened? Do you have trouble sleeping at night? Do you find yourself tossing restlessly in bed? I wonder why. Perhaps you saw something during the waking day that troubled you. What was it? That strange man on the bus, or the curious manner of that woman in the drugstore? Or maybe your story is like the bizarre incident of the life of John LeGrew. John LeGrew was a bachelor, but not by choice. For 12 long years since the war, he'd supported his ailing mother and denied his own happiness. You see, his anemic salary at the watch factory had not permitted any thoughts of increasing the LeGrew household. But John had had something out of life. In 1944 in France, during the war, he had met Denise Francon, the wonderful little French girl who had been the only love of John's shallow life. But a bombardment of her little village and the silence that followed had left John with only one conclusion. Denise was dead. Well, the war ended, and he had returned to America, his mother, and the watchmen. and the dull years had ticked away with the clocks. But one day, everything changed. John came home after a day at the factory, and his mother said that a girl named Denise had called and wanted to talk to him. John couldn't believe his ears. There must be some mistake. Denise was dead. She had to be. But no. During dinner, the telephone in the hallway rang again. John rushed to answer it. It was impossible. It was unbelievable. But the sweet voice on the other end of the line was the same broken English of Denise Francois. And a dozen questions spilled from his heart. Where was she? How had she been? Why had she waited all these years to get in touch with him? Did she still love him? But oddly, Denise couldn't say much. Her voice seemed faint and shaky. But she gave out a telephone number. Butterfield 8-7777. And insisted that John should call her at that number at midnight. All the rest of the evening, John was in a fever of impatience. The tiny clock in the bureau mocked him as the hour and minute hand slowly crawled round to the appointed hour. Finally, it was midnight, and John lifted the phone from the hook and dialed the number. A male voice asked who was calling. Surprised, John wanted to know if he had the right number. Yes, it was Butterfield 8-7777. Whom did he want to speak to? John asked for Denise Francois. The voice seemed puzzled. Sorry, I don't seem to recognize the name. John's voice trembled. I'm sorry, he said, but this number was given to me to call at midnight, and the man's voice interrupted him, saying, oh, of course, I beg your pardon. Denise Francois? Yes, certainly, I remember now. The body was delivered for embalming yesterday morning. Looks like an automobile accident, and yet, well, in the midst of life, we are in death. John LeGrew hung up and sat in his chair staring at the wall for a long, long time. And to this day, he still sits staring at a wall and hears a voice, a soft, sweet, trembling voice asking him to call and call and call. Well, I leave you. This is Woodlawn. What? Oh, I thought you knew. The Woodlawn Cemetery is my destination. You see, I live here. Goodbye for a while, and do call me when you get a chance.
Продолжаем путешествовать по темным уголкам вместе с Борисом Карловым. Магия голоса вслед за магией изображения.
Are you one of the frightened? Careful now. Please don't walk under the ladder that someone has placed so carelessly against the building wall there. Possibly a sign painter is working there, but that ladder can only bring you trouble. Did you ever hear of the tale of the two robbers? It was in the days of medieval history, the days of darkness and gothic gloom and death. Their names were Gaspar and Francois. They were young men, but old in the ways of treachery and villainy. They cut throats for fun as well as money. But one April night, Gaspar and Francois rousted and reveled in the infamous tavern of the Côte d'Or. They'd been idle for days, and so had taken recourse in drunken debauchery. Their fingers itched for their curious profession. They hungered to ply their wicked trade. And so, when a fat, wealthy merchant left the tavern, after announcing loudly to one and all his riches in his little house at the end of the town, Gaspar and Francois lurched in pursuit. The Paris streets were dark and ill-lit, but the two drunken thieves followed their prey with eyes long used to the darkness. Happily, the distance was not far. Soon the fat merchant turned into a cobbled courtyard and entered a stone, ivy-covered building. Gaspar and Francois waited patiently, and when candlelight flickered in a second-story window, they made their plans. It was the work of a second to climb the wall surrounding the house, and in the darkness of the courtyard, they found a crude wooden ladder propped near the barn door. Gaspar placed it gently against the vines until the top rung rested directly below the fat merchant's window. Francois licked his lips greedily, and his dirty fingers tightened about the dagger in his hand. He would make short work of the fat merchant. But Gaspar was already mounting the ladder as stealthily as a cat. His knife gleamed in the darkness. He'd very nearly reached the top rung when the casement windows flew open, and there was the fat merchant thrusting a lighted torch into his face. Gaspar screamed terribly, lashing out with his knife. But this fat merchant had been rich too long and stayed fat because he'd known how to take care of himself and his money. The long sword in his fat fingers buried itself in Gaspar's chest up to the hilt. At the bottom of the ladder, Francois panicked and scrambled off the rungs, coming around behind the ladder and hiding underneath it, hugging the wall. He stared up above him as the great bulk of Gaspar's dead body sagged against the rungs. The merchant was shouting to the police at the top of his lungs. Francois was frozen where he stood, the drunkenness of the evening still boiling in his blood. His eyes flashed about the courtyard, looking for the best avenue of escape, and then Gaspar's body, unevenly balanced on the ladder, toppled through the space of one set of rungs and landed in front of Francois. Francois's eyes bulged with surprise, and a bloody moan bubbled from his dirty throat as the point of the sword jutting from Gaspar's back knifed into his heart. When the police arrived to see what the commotion was, they found Gaspar and Francois huddled behind the ladder, jammed against the wall, like two frightened children locked in each other's arms against the cold. And there you are. Legend has it, of course, that Francois walked under a ladder and died terribly, but, well, you've heard the story, and so please be careful. You never can tell, can you? Well, upon my soul, here comes the sign painter to get his ladder, and do you know, my friend, you've been standing under it for the longest time.
Да, мы не можем предсказывать будущее. Классический рисунок роли чудовища Борис Карлов повторил в фильме «Невеста Франкенштейна».
Yes, I went for a little walk. And that year, and in years soon after, in the old dark house, the black cat and the raven, I went for other little walks that somehow always panicked people. And then, in 1935, I met Miss Elsa Lanchester in the scream heard around the world. That was the reaction from Mrs. Lawton when she was introduced to me in
The Bride of Frankenstein.
And that was the voice of the late Ernest Thesiger, playing the peculiar Dr. Pretorius. I found my voice in this sequel and mumbled a few lines. Perhaps you'd like to hear them again.
В уютной комнате перед камином в старинном замке сидят три великих человека: лорд Байрон, Перси Шелли и его жена Мэри. Так начинается фильм. Они обсуждают только что написанный Мэри роман «Франкенштейн», попутно кратко пересказывая содержание фильма. После долгой дискуссии мужчины заявляют, что чудовище Франкенштейна, которого, кстати, играл Борис Карлов, не должно просто так погибнуть. Они требуют от писательницы продолжения. Сначала она отказывается, но потом поддается на уговоры и импровизирует. Первые строчки продолжения. Никому в голову не могло прийти, что чудовище выжило в огне. Действительно, в фильме монстру удается освободиться и скрыться. Оно находит приют в уединенном доме слепого отшельника. Не зная, кто его гость, старик учит чудовище говорить простые слова, объясняет их смысл, играет ему на скрипке. Но как только в дверях хижины появляются два охотника, чудовищу снова приходится бежать.
And now for our lesson. Remember, this is bread. Bread.
Bread.
And this is wine. To drink.
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 Good. Good.
We are friends, you and I. Friends.
Friends.
Good.
Good.
Before you came, I was all alone. It is bad to be alone.
Alone. Bad. Friend. Good. Friend. Good.
Now come here. And what is this? This is wood for the fire.
Wood.
And this is fire. No, no. Fire is good.
Fire, no good.
There is good and there is bad.
Good. Bad.
Кстати, невеста в фильме «Невеста Франкенштейна» — это единственный классический чудовищный персонаж в фильмах студии Universal, который никого не убивает, абсолютно мирный монстр.
But in the end, I decided my reluctant bride and I were better off dead, and told Colin Clive so in no uncertain terms.
I can't leave them, I can't!
Yes, go! You live! Go! You stay. We belong dead.
От фильма Бориса Карлова к его же страшной истории на ночь. Поговорим снова о предсказании будущего.
Are you one of the frightened? Have you had your fortune told recently? Did the gypsy read cards or look into a crystal ball to tell you what the future held in store for you? The three Gamboli sisters wanted to know, and their fortune teller told them one sunny day in Italy. Now the Gamboli sisters were triplets. They were as like as three peas in a pod, and their names were Rita, Jasa, and Lena, and since their parents' death they had supported themselves as seamstresses. Their 19th birthday was the day of the big festival in the town square. The sisters went into the tent of the fortune teller and demanded of the old crone there to know their fortunes and how soon they would marry. The old crone gazed into the crystal and shook her craggy, ancient head. You will never marry, my dear, she cackled, because you'll all be dead before the year is out. The girls laughed, but deep in their hearts there came a dim sense of fear. The bony fingers singled out Rita and told her that she would die of pneumonia. Jasa and Lena trembled when the old woman whispered something far more terrible about them. Jasa would die at Lena's hands, and Lena in turn would die because of killing her sister. Now they were sure the old woman was crazy, and shouting insults at her, they bounced out of the tent to seek their admirers and the warmth and gaiety of the festival. But the old gypsy's words stayed with them. Within a month, Rita died on the night of a full moon of pneumonia. Jason and Lena were heartbroken and chilled with the prophecy that seemed to be coming true. All the village mourned, and the girls in their bereavement sought to find some comfort in love. But such is fortune. They both fell in love with the same man, a tall, dashing man of the village, Antonio. Lena and Jason had always loved each other as sisters, but now they were women both vying for the same man. One night, 3 months to the day of Rita's death, they went at each other like tigresses in their little hut on the north end of the village. In a craze of passion, Lena plunged her seamstress's shears deep into Jason's heart. Lena, overcome first with remorse and then fear, dragged her sister's body out to the well, and with the strength of the guilty one who hides a crime, dropped Jason's body down into the dark, slimy interior. She fled back into the house and fell to her knees before the statue of the Madonna on the kitchen wall and prayed for forgiveness. In her mad desire for Antonio, she'd forgotten the gypsy woman's dire prophecy, and now she had Antonio. And she told the people of the village that Jason had run away because Antonio preferred her, her sister. But on the day of the wedding, Lena, resplendent in her lace bridal gown, went to the well and stared down into the place where her sister's body was hidden from the eyes of the world. In the few inches of dirty, scummy water of the well's bottom, she saw the huddled outline of Jason's decayed body there. Quite unexpectedly, a bat flew up out of the well and settled in Lena's black, luxuriant hair. Screaming and twisting, she tried to beat it off, but the bat flapped its wings maddeningly and hung on. Lena whirled and tripped over the rim of the well. Screaming like a banshee, her fingernails raking the walls as she fell. When the townspeople lowered a ladder into the well, they found the bodies. And even Antonio could see that the point of the seamstress shears sticking out through Jason's back had knifed right into Lena's falling body. So the prophecy was fulfilled. Rita died of pneumonia. Lena killed Jason, and Jason killed Lena. A triple slay, you might call it, but where was I? Oh, yes, your fortune, my dear. Now, let's see. Ah, yes, I think you're going to kill somebody.
Борис Карлов, его биография насыщена кино- и телевизионными работами. Он был ведущим нескольких циклов жанровых телепрограмм, сыграл главную роль в британском телесериале, участвовал в многочисленных радиопостановках, вот часть из которых мы слышали, и в озвучивании нескольких мультипликационных фильмов. Но его образ, образ монстра Франкенштейна, маска, созданная им, так и осталась неповторимой, копируемой всеми возможными способами. Сегодня мы слышали, как эта маска звучит, но что мешает еще раз пересмотреть то, как она выглядит, и устроить небольшой карнавал монстров.
An eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise. And suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mask.
He did the monster mask.
The monster mask.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mask.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mask.
He did the monster mask. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires feast, the ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mask.
They did the monster mask.
The monster mask.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mask.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mask.
They did the monster mash. The zombies were having fun. The party had just begun. The guests included Wolfman, Dracula, and his son. The scene was rocking, all were digging the sounds. Igor on chains, backed by his baying hounds. The coffin bangers were about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker Five.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They played the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash. Out from his coffin, Rack's voice did ring. Seemed he was troubled by just one thing. Opened the lid and shook his fist and said, "Whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?"
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash.
The monster mash.
And it's a graveyard smash.
It's now the mash.
It's caught on in a flash.
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash. Now everything's cool. Drax a part of the band, and my monster mash is the hit of the land. For you, the living, this mash was meant to. When you get to my door, tell them what it said.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
The monster mash.
And do my graveyard smash.
Then you can mash.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
Mash.
Easy, Igor. You impetuous young boy.
Mash cool.
Monster mash.
Monster
mash.